Well, Mars is set for a close encounter with Earth, approaching to within 43.1 million miles of our planet in the early hours of Sunday. And with good conditions and a lack of any clouds out there, amateur astronomers will be able to get an unusually great glimpse of Mars. The red planet will not swing this close to Earth for another 13 years. Small telescopes will be able to see Mars as a brilliant ball. Observers with more powerful instruments will be able to see features on the surface. Maybe, because Richard C. Hoagland tells us the red planet right now is going through one heck of a dust storm. So Richard C. Hoagland, who, by the way, is up in the International Space Station measuring the distance from Earth to the Mars with a tape measure, will be our guest in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, he's the Coast to Coast AM science advisor. He heads up the enterprisemission.com. He is the producer and creator of the critically acclaimed Godman and ET series, which we'll tell you about in a moment. He is Richard C. Hoagland. You're not really up at the ISS measuring for Mars, are you?
I'll never tell.
Well, it's pretty darn good quality if you are up there.
Well, I'm glad, because at this end, this phone sounds terrible tonight, so I'm glad you can hear me.
Yeah, so far so good. As a matter of fact, when I interviewed the two astronauts at the time who were up there, I think it was about a year ago, the quality was incredible, Richard.
Well, it should be. It's a broadband signal. It's an S-band signal, goes up to the Tedra satellite, comes down to liquid-cooled helium maser amplifiers, then sent back up by a satellite commercially and down to you, so it should sound like next door. I mean, we are paying billions and billions, as Carl used to say, for the space program, so it should have a decent phone link.
Well, it could be. Hey, right pre-Halloween, I wanted to get you on to talk about the red planet, and just as we were planning this, she's kicking up all kinds of dust. What's going on up there?
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, a couple nights ago, on Thursday night, a bright dot erupted to the west of Meridiani Sinus, which is the double-forked meridian marking on Mars that is kind of like the equivalent of Greenwich on Earth. It's, by the way, where one of the two rovers, the Opportunity rover, is down on the surface, prowling around on the landscape.
Okay. Still going strong.
Still going strong. You know, it's like the Energizer Bunny, going and going. Those things were only supposed to be, you know, the warranty was, what, 3 months?
3 months.
Days?
And then they got a little bit more money to keep them going, but they didn't know.
Well, it's not the money that keeps them going. It's the hardware on Mars. The money is simply to keep the people going, to interpret the signals and downlink the data and send up the commands and do all the stuff that you would do when the thing is working and working and working. Well, so, I mean, we really got our money's worth from those two rovers.
Thanks to the winds that keep blowing the dust off those solar panels, right?
Yes, and the matter of fact, the Opportunity rover, which is on the fringes of this dust storm, is seeing some winds kick up, and they say that it's going to maybe be a kind of a null. In other words, the dust storm will deposit dust on the panels, but the winds that the dust storm kicks up may blow the dust off the panels that the storm is depositing. So they're actually carrying out measurements on the surface of this thing that any amateur with any decent telescope anywhere in the Western Hemisphere can see. Now, you won't be able to see it from the Eastern Hemisphere. For the folks listening to us on the Internet in Australia or Hong Kong or Singapore, you're out of luck, because the two rotations of the two planets are almost exactly the same. A day on Mars is 24 hours, you know, 37 minutes. So if you're on the wrong side of Mars in terms of looking at something from Earth, it takes weeks for the very slow rotation difference to bring that object around to where you can see it on the other side of the planet. We're fortunate in that amateurs looking up at Mars high in the sky right now, that brilliant, brilliant, unblinking red dot high in the atmosphere, that's Mars, 43 million miles away. And if you look really close right now, you'll see that little orange patch just to the right of the center line, and that's the dust storm. Now, this dust storm could expand to encompass, as other dust storms have in the past, the entire planet, George. So this is something that amateurs are going to want to watch.
Now, does this happen a lot on Mars, a dust storm of this magnitude?
Well, we think it happens roughly every 2 years when Mars gets closest to the sun in its elliptical orbit, and it's caused by the increased solar heating. Unlike Earth, which is almost a circular orbit, you know, there's like a million miles difference between our farthest and closest point out of 93 million. Mars has a very substantial ellipticity, so it can get a lot closer in the southern hemisphere during the summer than it does in the northern hemisphere, and that produces these temperature asymmetries, thermal instabilities, and winds that kick up dust. And I remember vividly when I was going to JPL back in 71, when Mariner 9 in November was going into orbit for the first time. We put a spacecraft into orbit around Mars, and we were looking forward breathlessly to really stunning pictures. The first spacecraft, as you know, had flown by in previous years. They had not stopped and gone into orbit. So we were looking forward to incredibly good pictures for the state of the art of 1971. And unfortunately, a whole bunch of us had gathered, you know, like the creme de la creme of space. Arthur Clarke was there. Wernher von Braun was there. My old friend Phil Chapman, who was a science astronaut. I did some experiments, you know, to and from the moon with him, me on the ground, of course. And we were all basically just gazing at these TV screens that were pitch blank. They had no detail. One of the kind of pundits said that, you know, because you put these pictures in a spacecraft through a computer process called enhancement, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, one wag said, well, we got raw pictures of bed sheets, and then we got enhanced pictures of enhanced bed sheets, because it was like looking at a blank screen because of the dust. And it wasn't until months later that the dust settled, and we got our first look at strange features on Mars that transformed everyone's perception of what Mars had been from the beginning of the space age, because it turned out that in the flybys, we'd been looking at the wrong side of Mars, which was where all the dull stuff was, all the exciting stuff. You had to go into orbit and stay there, and then we had the dust storm that had to clear in months later. So tonight, if amateurs with any decent telescope, 10-inch, 5-inch, 12-inch, look at Mars, you will see this ruddy, salmon-colored planet with these kind of bluish-gray, greenish markings. And then just to the right of the center of the disk, there'll be this brilliant yellow splotch, and that's the burgeoning dust storm that could, in the next several days, envelop the whole planet.
I bet there'll be a run on telescopes by tomorrow sometime.
Well, back in 2003, George, when Mars was closer than it had been in 60,000 years, there was an enormous run on telescopes. I mean, you could not buy a telescope through any of the chains or the Walmarts or the, you know, even the high-end optical companies for love nor money, because people were media, you know, driven to go and find something to look at Mars. It's a little less this year because we've had news much closer to home, like hurricanes and disasters and all that. But there's still, by the way, it isn't a magic night. There is a kind of a misimpression that if you don't get it Saturday night, you're going to miss it for the next, you know, 2 years.
Yeah, it's not like it's going to disappear.
Absolutely not. It will be within this 40-plus million-mile range for days and days and days as these two planets orbiting in the same direction come kind of parallel to each other. Think of two racehorses going around a track. And we're on the inside track, and Mars is on the outside track, and the inner track horse or planet moves faster. So we're overtaking Mars, but there's an arc there where we're kind of keeping pace. So for the next several weeks, Mars will be exquisitely placed high in the sky at midnight, opposite the sun, very high because of the tilt of the two planets now and the geometry, so that anybody with a half-decent telescope will have a really breathtaking view that will not be repeated, as you said, for 13 years until 2018.
If you have even one of these 3-inch scopes, what will you see?
That was my first telescope.
Me too.
And I saw Mars. I saw the polar caps. And my life, as you obviously know, George, was never the same.
And you know what? Because of that telescope, either was ours. Because
it's
of you.
It's amazing how those, I used to call them nodal points in your life.
Yep.
Those things that if you went this way, if you didn't do that thing, your life would be totally different.
Exactly.
And I can look back, you know, that and other things in my career, in my relationships. I mean, I can. It's almost like beads on a string, or pearls in a necklace, where each of these markers determines where your life has been and is going to go.
Well, did I ever tell you about my boyhood friend, Gary Frank? And he and I would launch these little toy rockets that we would get from a company called Estes.
Estes, yeah.
All right, Estes.
Yep.
And he would, we would build a rocket together, and the little engine was a little solid propellant engine. He'd stick it in the rocket, and then you'd stick these wires in there and hook it up to a battery, push a button, and off it would go. Well, his job was to put the solid propellant engine, as we called it, into the rocket and do the launch. My job was to broadcast the launch to everybody in the neighborhood.
Oh, my God.
And so I go into broadcasting. Gary Frank, you ready for this little drum roll? Goes off to build the engines for the space shuttle.
You're kidding.
Nope, swear to God. And you talk about events that affect your lives. That was one of them for both of us.
Well, my old friend, G. Harry Stein, I mean, I'm sure your friend must have gotten Harry's handbook, the Model Rocketeer's handbook.
Yes.
It was the Bible of Estes rockets and other various firms' rockets, with the little motors you put in the airframe. And you sent up this steel or iron rod, and they could climb like to 1,000 or 2,000 feet. Harry wrote the book, and one of those nodal points was when Harry's path and mine crossed, and we became really good friends. And then through him, I met Robert Heinlein, who was the dean of American science fiction, who single-handedly probably created more NASA engineers and scientists on the planet than any other human being, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's this incredibly interconnected web, George.
I'm halfway tempted, because you're going to be in Los Angeles in February, I hear.
Yeah, for the Conscious Life Expo.
I'm halfway tempted to build a little Estes rocket and have you and I go out to some park and launch it.
Oh, that would be cool. Yeah, Robin and I are speaking at the Conscious Life Expo, and I would love to do that.
That would be fun.
I haven't done that in years.
You remind me of a professor I had. I guess they're just a teacher, science teacher in high school. They weren't professors. And he would come in with a bag, a big bag, and he'd pull out science experiments out of it. And we never knew what he was going to present to us, but we couldn't wait for him to open up that bag. You remind me of that guy.
Sounds like the science teacher I had in high school, Mr. Mulak.
And what did Mr. Mulak?
Well, he had a very vivid demonstration of the conservation of energy. We had a very old high school, Classical High in Springfield, Massachusetts, and there was this very tall physics lab that like went up two or three stories, and he had a steel wire suspended from the roof, and on the end of this wire, which was like, 30 feet, 40 feet long, he had a cannonball, a big, heavy, massive cannonball. And he loved to absolutely terrify first-year students, because what he would do on the first day of class is he would go over to the side of the room and he would draw this cannonball on the steel wire back to his chin as he's standing with his back to the wall. And he'd let it go. And he's just standing there, and we're watching this thing swing out and out and out and up toward the other side of the room, and then it stopped, and then it swung back and back and back. And he's standing there, and this cannonball is rushing at him, and he stands perfectly still, and it comes to within an inch of his chin and stops.
Oh.
And he looks at us, and he says, conservation of momentum.
I love it. Hey, I want your reaction to a couple guests I had on this week.
Okay.
First one, Lawrence Krauss, talked about parallel dimensions, maybe extra universes. Never asked you about that. What do you think?
Well, that's part of, you know, our hyperdimensional model, and the mainstream guys are talking about, other dimensions and parallel universes. So there does seem to be a convergence that this is not the only reality that there is. And in fact, if you can do it right, if you can develop the technology, you might be able to port yourself between the dimensions, in which case we could explain, you know, such phenomena as shadow people, mm-hmm. things like that.
I think you're right.
As natural portals between these universes that are otherwise isolated.
Yep. Somehow they're overlapping or something. Something's
happening. At a certain point, yeah.
Jerome Corsi, Craig Smith on the show to talk about Black Gold Stranglehold. They believe this planet creates and makes its own oil, that it's abiotic, does not come from dinosaurs and decayed plant life.
That was a phenomenal show. You really kept me up until I had to go to bed because I had some meetings in the morning. But I got to say that, you know, as I was listening, and they gave proper credit to Tommy Gold, Professor Thomas
yes.
Gold from Cornell, who was the first major guy to write about and to actually put his money where his mouth is. Did you know that Tommy Gold actually sponsored an oil drilling expedition in the North Sea to test his theory?
I did not.
That gold is abiotic, that it's not produced by dead dinosaurs, as your guest said. And he had modest success, but he didn't have enough financing, and obviously the oil companies were not going to help him. Because if he's right, and if your guests are right, we are in the midst of the biggest con in history, George.
There's no question about it. Hey, Richard, we're on the air that night taking phone calls from truck drivers who are paying a fortune for diesel. The next day, diesel drops by almost 30 cents a gallon. Now, that's weird.
That's not economics. That's politics.
Yes.
Now, what's interesting is that, you know, apropos of Mars, back in 2000, I discovered a strange feature on Mars that became known as the seeps, these things that kind of are dark black, and they seem to flow downhill. They look exactly like a fluid flowing from a higher level to a lower level. And NASA for years and years has claimed, oh, they're just avalanches. But they appear to be some kind of liquid. What's ironic is that when I saw it, my first impression, and my colleague Mike Barra, you know, agreed with me, and we posted this on Enterprise in 2000, that it was probably water, that there's a lot of water on Mars, and it was melting, and it was causing these rivulets to, you know, it almost looked like moistened desert sand when you get a freshet of water, and it makes the sand darker. But the other possibility that I mentioned in the press release that we issued in 2000 was that it could be a demonstration of Tommy Gold's idea, that we could be seeing seeps of oil produced not from life processes, you know, ancient Martian forests or Martian dinosaurs,
right.
But abiotically through the planetary processes of the most abundant elements that make up planets, which is carbon and hydrogen and, you know, things like that. I mean, that's why, you know, this stuff is a hydrocarbon, because it's basically carbon and hydrogen in complex molecules. And if that's true, it means that when the first explorers get to Mars, be they Americans or Japanese or Russians or whatever, they may strike oil. And wouldn't that be an absolute hoot? Wouldn't that be an incredible thing if the reason that NASA has been so cheery about telling us the truth about Mars is that they really don't want to, you know, reveal what the oil companies don't want revealed, which is that planets create oil in incredible abundance, and we're living in an era of scarcity that's artificial and designed. I mean, Exxon made, what, $10
billion
this last quarter?
Just the quarter. You want to stick around for questions?
Sure.
All right, we'll do that. Questions for Richard C. Hoagland. We talk about the face on Mars, hurricanes, space, the shuttle. It's all yours. And I'll be back to give you a phone number for God, Man, and E.T. in a moment. And we'll have open lines next hour with a special Halloween hotline I'm going to open up for you. I'm also going to tell you about a house for sale in St. Louis that I'm interested in, not in moving in, but I'll tell you why. It is one heck of a story. Hey, you know, all around this country, the courts, the schools, everybody seems to be arguing over intelligent design. Just who created what? What can you say? What can't you say? I mean, if you haven't seen Richard C. Hoagland's God, Man, and E.T. DVD series, you're missing something. It's available to you when you go to the enterprisemission.com website or you can call this toll-free number as well. That's 1-877. Different toll-free numbers have different numbers to start. This one's 877-345-6222. That's 877-345-6222, or you can go to the enterprisemission.com website. It's called God, Man, and E.T. Richard C., I don't know what kind of red tape we'll have to go through. These rockets don't really go up that high, I think like 1,200, 1,300 feet. But there are already efforts underway to get us to launch this thing at the Rose Bowl.
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention that, because I was thinking in the break, what we really should do is go over to JPL, because that's how JPL started. In that old Arroyo, just off, not Route 2, 410?
Yes, I think that's it.
Up in that Arroyo, Parsons and Von Neumann and some others basically launched model rockets, which led to the contract with the Army back in the 40s for the development of the JATO, Jet-Assisted Takeoff System, which is where JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, as part of Caltech, got its name. And every Halloween, in fact, right now, if you go up as part of the open house, they have a tableau with mannequins in that Arroyo depicting the founders of JPL launching their model rockets that led to the American Space Program.
Well, we can videotape this and put it on both our websites.
That'd be kind of cool. I was thinking if we went up there, the odds are that one of three things would happen. A, we could blow ourselves up, low probability.
Well, wait a minute. A, you're putting the engine in the rocket, not me, you would blow yourself up.
Thanks a lot, George. Okay.
Somebody's got to be around to report on your demise.
So, B, Homeland Security would pick us up.
True.
Or C, NASA Security would pick us up, and we get on the inside, and who knows what we could find out then.
That's why we go to the Rose Bowl.
Okay.
We try for that.
Okay.
Let's go to the phones. Conversations with Richard C. Hoagland this hour. Here we go. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes.
Mr. Hoagland, it's an honor to speak with you.
Yeah, well, thank
your
you.
Book when it came out, The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever. Thanks very much for the Star Trek reference back when it wasn't nearly as cool as it is today. In your book, you had many pictures of formations on the Cydonia Mensa, and you had generally referred to them as the city.
Yep.
I've since seen the later photographs of the face on Mars and tried to puzzle through how that fits in with what we were seeing before.
Right.
But have there been other pictures, better resolution, taken of any of those other features, like the fortress?
Actually, yeah. Mars Global Surveyor has taken over the years. Malin has kept taking pictures of Cydonia. Mm-hmm. Kind of interesting because of a piece of landscape on Mars where all the mainstream scientists claim there's no interest.
Yes.
Cydonia is the most photographed region of Mars, bar none.
I just haven't,
now, what's
I haven't
wrong
seen any other than the face.
Picture.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, there are other high-resolution features. If you go to my fifth edition of Monuments, which is out, you know, now at any of the major bookstores.
Okay.
You'll see the latest collection of pictures. These objects, when you look at them close up with the high-res camera on the Surveyor spacecraft,
mm-hmm.
they're in pretty bad shape.
Mm.
But I would imagine, I mean, I was extrapolating back in the early 90s when we started seriously looking at this, that we would expect to see things in bad shape because, you know, it's kind of like what I call the Gigi phenomenon. Remember that famous movie with Marie Chevalier?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And there was a great song in there where he says, "Have I been standing up too close or back too far?"
Oh, yeah.
If you stand up too close to stuff that's really, really old and beaten the hell out of because of winds and weather and all that, mm-hmm. it'll look bad.
Right.
If you stand back too far, you don't see any detail. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that the Viking data, was just at the optimum range with the camera state-of-the-art we had in the 70s.
I see.
To get us the best pictures, to get us really the best view up until we land and walk in the door.
Sure.
Because in order to really verify that that stuff is real, most folks are going to have to wait till an astronaut, you know, goes inside and says back to Houston, "You'll never believe what I'm seeing."
I love it.
Let me say that your book changed my whole view of not only the space program, but of all official information I was being given, particularly by anything to do with the government.
Well, thank you, because it did the same thing to me. I mean, I was pretty naive before I started this, and I thought that, you know, the folks that we paid all this money to go and find out what's out there would tell us the truth. And frankly, I was as stunned as anybody to realize that we have to pry it out of them over, as Charlton Heston used to say, their cold, dead hands before we can get our data.
You know, Richard, you sound like the modern-day Don Herbert, Mr. Wizard. You could be. My brain is working already.
Oh, boy.
Hey, thanks for the phone call. Appreciate you being on with Richard C. Hoagland. Next up, first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Go ahead.
Hey, this is Charles Robbins from Louisiana.
Hey, Charles. How are things, by the way, down there where you are?
Well, it seems to be getting back to kind of normal.
Good.
Sort of, you know.
I guess as much as you can.
They just opened up the mall down there in New Orleans today.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Civilization has come back.
Yeah, a little bit. Look, I have been listening to your program for, I guess, about 2.5 years. There's a really big story behind all the things that I'm interested in and why I listen to your show, George. And for Richard Hoagland, his book, I did read The Monuments of Mars,
yes,
about probably 7 years ago, so I don't really remember it that well. But there were things in there that were talking about hyperdimensional energies.
Yes.
And I've studied crop circle patterns. And then I got a hold of a book called Sacred Geometry. And what I want to know is the hyperdimensional energies that you're speaking of, are these energies ones that exist in waveforms that's emitted by the gravitational, planetary energy? I mean, I don't know exactly how to put this.
You put it perfectly, because the answer is yes. Now, the more complicated physics is that the real information energy is coming from other dimensions, but it's being modulated through this plenum in our reality in three dimensions called the ether. The ether is not dead, Jim. It really exists, and it can be made to do work. And it's really interesting, because if history had flowed the way it was supposed to, the Katrina disaster that we all watched unfold in slow, agonizing motion would never have taken place. What was the primary cause of the loss of all those people's homes and most of those people's lives in New Orleans? Lack of power, lack of energy. When the grid failed because of the hurricane and the pumps couldn't keep the levees pumped out and they collapsed and the pumps couldn't keep up with the water coming in, it was a disaster written in stone. If there had been an independent hyperdimensional power supply for every home, for the pumps, for the downtown section, New Orleans would have lived a different history in those agonizing 2 days we all watched on television.
That is so true. So true indeed. Wildcard line, you're on with Richard C. Hoagland.
Good evening. Fred from Flushing, 1570 Super Talk.
That's in Michigan.
Michigan, indeed. It's a blustery 32 degrees out right now.
Ah, yes, my old home state.
Well, I've got two questions for Richard.
Sure.
I saw a video, Richard, called Hemp and the Rule of Law on Free Speech TV, and I encourage all Coast listeners, if they have Dish Network or DirecTV, to start watching Free Speech, because they run a whole array of documentaries that are totally indispensable to the subject matter handled by Coast on a regular basis. In the video, Richard, they show Henry Ford in 1941 having produced a fully plastic automobile from hemp. He's got some big old guys pounding on this thing with sledgehammers. It's not denting it, it's not chipping it, it's doing nothing but bouncing off. Henry Ford also proved that hemp oil could be used in diesel engines as a fuel source. So why do you suppose the government has such a vengeance against the use of hemp?
One word, greed.
Okay.
For the same reason we're living under the nightmare of this peak oil scenario, where they can jack the price up and lower it, you know, 30 cents in a 24-hour period. This is not free enterprise economics. This isn't business 101 taught at the Wharton School. This is feudalism. As one of George's guests the other night, I think it was Alex Jones, talked about that we're living in another feudal era where a few robber barons have everybody else as serfs because they control this extraordinary priceless commodity called an energy supply, i.e. oil, and they can raise and lower the price at will. And there isn't much, unless we all get together and demand it, that we can do about it. So I'm not surprised at all that Henry Ford was producing, as he produced many innovations, a car that was basically made out of a natural material that you could grow on farms that would be renewable and would be much cheaper. I mean, a hemp car, a plastic car that was that strong, can you imagine how much gas you would save instead of having to shuffle along several tons of steel?
Richard, that's a segue into my second question. Now, George, you've interviewed the editor of Nexus Magazine, haven't you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
In the December 96, January 97 issue of Nexus, they featured an article of an engineer who cites, Richard, I'd say he cited about 13, maybe 16 U.S. patents for high-mileage engine systems of various designs. Now, are U.S. patents granted to non-functional devices?
Not normally, no.
Well, I tell you, that would be one whale of an interview there, George, with that fella.
Sure would. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being part of the program. Not a lot of time left with Richard C. Hoagland. More calls, so let's take as many as we can. Wildcard line, you're up. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes,
this
sir.
Is Jack. Hi, George.
Jack,
hi, Richard.
Welcome.
Hi, Jack.
How you gentlemen doing tonight?
Good.
I've got some novice questions. When I say novice, I mean really novice.
In that case, I'll probably be able to answer it. Sorry, Richard.
Where in the sky shall we look for Mars, first of all?
Okay, right now at midnight, and I'm in Mountain Time, so I'm at 12:51. What time zone are you in?
I'm Eastern.
Okay, you're Eastern, so it's a couple hours past midnight.
Yes.
So what you want to do is to look a little bit past the zenith. You know where the zenith is? It's the highest point in the sky.
Yes.
Look toward the west by about two fists. Hold your fist out in front of your eyes, and about two fists down, you'll see this brilliant orangish dot surrounded by nothing comparably bright.
Right.
Not twinkling. It's steady. That's
right.
Mars.
Right. So it's basically in the western sky.
In the western sky.
At what, about 75, 80 degrees?
Something like that, yeah, because the Earth rotates 15 degrees per hour.
Right.
So it's 2 hours past midnight. It'll be in the zenith at midnight. So let's say it's 30 degrees.
That's right now.
Past zenith. So
it's 3 in the morning out there.
From the western horizon.
It's 3, and it's almost 3 in the morning out there on the East Coast.
Yeah.
So it should be happening now.
Okay.
You can't miss it. It's the only bright orange thing up there looking toward the west from the East Coast.
Right. I thought I was right.
If you're in L.A., it'll be just at the meridian now.
Right, but there's so much light pollution in L.A.
So you'll be able to see it. It's so damn bright.
Okay,
there's
great.
No question you'll be able to see it even in a big city.
By the way, Richard, this weekend, daylight saving time ends
for the
year. Time to flip back 1 hour.
At 2 a.m., I believe.
Do you like that?
You know, it came, it's part of an historical accident. What was intriguing to me is how the Bush administration tried to get them to tack on another period of daylight savings time, and that's a whole show in and of itself because there may be other factors besides just saving energy that had to do with that.
Really?
Yep.
All right. I'll,
maybe you know me. I see conspiracies everywhere.
Why, you do. You absolutely do. I bet when you go out to dinner with Robin and the waiter brings your food, you think there's a conspiracy there. And you probably hire Robin to eat the dinner first, don't you?
Well, she's my food taster.
She's the taster. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, guys. This is Patrick in Phoenix.
Hi,
how you doing?
Go ahead.
Great show. Richard, I was going through some old magazines a while back, and I stumbled upon an old, I believe, 1981 issue of Future Life.
Okay.
And it was an article written by Harlan Ellison. He was talking about Saturn and the Voyager flybys, and I believe his consultant was yourself. Do you remember that?
Harlan and I are old, old friends. I stole the subtitle for Monuments from him, and he was not very happy. And then Gene Roddenberry intervened and said, look, if he really bothers you, he says, I'll go sit on him. And fortunately, that never had to happen.
Well, it's a great article. It talks about getting the probe there and some of the science behind it. And, you know, I was wondering what you, if you thought back then, if you ever thought we'd have the resolution and the capabilities we have today for imaging distant planets and so forth.
Well, the Cassini mission is breathtaking, and we've all been so focused on the disasters, hurricanes, and all that. But I want to get back to the IAPTA series that I've been doing on Enterprise, and I want to come back and talk about some amazing new developments in the Saturn system that Cassini has given us, courtesy of those cameras and the other instruments. And, I mean, you know, we all imagine the ideal mission, but we never really imagined that NASA would get the money to do it in our lifetime, and now it's happened, and it's revolutionizing not only the knowledge of Saturn, but frankly the knowledge of the entire solar system, and I think, frankly, the knowledge of how we got here on Earth, and that gets back to a program that I think Lisa's putting together.
It's coming up. It's coming
design,
up. Yes, it is.
And some comments by a physicist, brilliant physicist named Freeman Dyson, having to do with the inability of natural evolution to explain life appearing in this solar system.
Oh, this is going to be a tremendous show.
And that gets to certain data that Cassini has given us that's not generally known, that's part of our IAPTA series. Anyway, bottom line, Harlan had no idea what he was writing, and we had no idea what we were participating in. We were all at JPL watching the Voyager mission live many years ago.
Well, Richard C. Hoagland, the Coast to Coast Science Advisor, heads up the EnterpriseMission.com and the DVD series that I talk about so much because I think the world of it, and it is, if you're into the intelligent design theory, Godman and E.T., his DVD series, go take a look at that. And the toll-free number, if you want to give it out as holiday gifts, by the way, it's pretty good. 877.
We're coming up on that time, George.
That's right. And you get them out in time?
Absolutely. No question.
877-345-6222. 877-345-6222. One last question. What are you wearing on Halloween Monday?
Robin Moore, let me tell you.
I bet you're going as a green Martian.
Close.
All right. Take care, Richard.
You too.
Have a good weekend. Open lines now for the next 2 hours, including a Halloween hotline. I'll tell you about that when I come right back.